Welcome to Dialogue on Teaching, Wabash Center's podcast series. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, director of the Wabash Center. Paul Myrie and Paul Utterback are our sound engineers. It is my pleasure to welcome to the conversation today Dr. Emily O. Gravett. Dr. Gravett is assistant director of the teaching area in the Center for Faculty Innovation and associate professor of religion with James Madison University. Welcome, Emily, to the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're both interested in human-centered classrooms, classrooms that take seriously the humanness of people, relational classrooms. But because relationships are messy and people are messy, that also means power dynamics are very much a part of the classroom. Help us get a handle on your approach to power dynamics in the classroom.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. This is tough, right? There's a lot of power dynamics in the classroom. And I think I've become increasingly aware of the power that I wield over students. Of course, you know, we have to give grades usually to our university about students' performance. And I'm the one who usually sets the syllabus and the deadlines. And I'm the one who creates the policies. And sometimes, you know, many of us are creating penalties with our students in terms of the way that they show up in our classes. And so I think about my own power in the classroom, the power that I wield over students. Of course, students also have a great deal of power in the classroom as well. And I think this part is less obvious, perhaps, to us. May show up in the form of bad course evaluations at the end of the semester or reviews that they might post publicly online that can affect whether their peers want to take our classes or not. It can also show up in, I think, more subtle ways. I think power can be wielded in very nuanced fashions, right? So it could be not coming to class, or it could be coming to class but really not being present, right? So if there's a topic that they dislike, or an author that has been assigned, or a line of thinking that they're not in agreement with or supportive of, they may check out, they may resist. So they may bodily be there, but they may be, sort of enacting some power that in the ways that they can, which may not, you know, seem like much, but actually can be quite powerful when we're in the classroom with them and we're trying to lead a lesson, or we're trying to motivate and stimulate and excite, and there's crickets, or there's frowny faces, or there's, you know, disinterest or even disdain. And so I think a lot about what's going on in that classroom. And for me, it's just a constant reminder that these are human beings, as you said at the very start. These are human beings that we are relating to, we are interacting with in the classroom. I'm a human being. My students are human beings. I think sometimes we forget that, and not even just in large classes where it's really often easy to forget, but even in smaller classes, forgetting that our students are people too, real people, people outside of the classroom.
I think that one of the adages of teaching is that we are supposed to meet our students where they are. And the challenge of teaching adult students, right? To me, that adage came from teaching children,
yes.
Right? Meet them where they are.
Yes.
The majority of our listeners teach adults.
Yes.
Which then begs the question, well, where are they, right? that so many of our students come from beyond our own personal experiences. The more diverse classrooms become, the more international students we have, the more globalized knowledges become a part of our classroom. So how has diversity and adult classrooms shaped these power dynamics, and how do
Yes.
we get our arms around, right, these giant notions?
Well, I think you made an important point at the start, which is that we are teaching adults, and sometimes our language and our attitudes don't reflect that. So I often hear colleagues refer to their students as kids, and I'm thinking the vast majority of my students are 18 years and older. These are adults. These are younger adults than I am. I'm getting older and older every year, it seems. The students in my classes are adults, and I think understanding that and treating them as such is really important. And they're coming to us from a variety of different places, like literally, as you're talking about, in terms of increase at our University of International Students, but also more metaphorically, too. Lots of different types of experiences and backgrounds and different identities. And for me, keeping in mind, okay, here's who I am, here's what I'm bringing. So I talk a lot about my whiteness in the classroom, for instance, or my gender. I identify as a woman. And then remembering and trying to keep in mind, okay, my students are also bringing with them identities that may or may not be visible or perceivable, identities that may or may not be relevant at any given moment, identities that they may still be trying to figure out in the classroom space. And for me, what's important in teaching is creating a learning environment in which students can bring and be those full selves, especially when those selves may be very different than me. There's nothing that pains me more than to hear stories from students about how they felt like they couldn't, express a certain opinion in class because it was very apparent that the professor held a different opinion, or to feel like certain identities were welcome and were validated, and others were dismissed or were disregarded in the classroom space. So there's that power again, that we have the responsibility and also the ability, I think, as instructors to, with the power that we have, create a situation, create a learning environment in which students can bring their sort of manifold selves to the learning experience, if they so choose. Some will not want to do that, or some will feel like this isn't the right moment, or this really isn't, a space that they want to do that. But I'd like for students to have that choice in my classroom.
So I think it is absolutely a challenge when students bring their identities, especially when they're different from the teacher, or different from the teacher's understanding and knowledges, right? I always try to put an S on knowledge now, knowledges of classrooms and even the content that they're teaching. But I want to go back to where you started earlier. What about the disaffected student? What about the student whose the dynamic is to withdraw, to be withdrawn, to not participate, to not be present, all those kinds of behaviors that signal discomfort or disregard or disrespect or just not having a good day. This is what I'm trying to get to. Is it our responsibility to coax and cajole adults?
I mean,
Right? So that's
that's a
part of the
great
dynamic
question.
too. Like, what's my role in this power dynamic when you've grown? But you don't want to be bothered.
And I talk with a lot of colleagues about this in my work at the center, because I do think our responsibility stops at a certain point. I mean, again, if we take them seriously as adults, they are making their own choices about whether to show up, how they want to show up, if they do show up, how they choose to engage with me and their peers and the material. And so I do think there's a limit to our responsibility in the classroom. And so I think that if you've created a learning environment, and there's lots of different ways to do this and different ways that I do this, if you've created a learning environment in which generally students do feel like they can show up authentically, with however they are and whoever they are, and then you're having this disinterest or this disengagement, I would say, everyone has a bad day, or sometimes people are sleep deprived, or sometimes they've got stuff going on in their personal lives and it has nothing to do with you or your class. And so I think it's also a presumption that we too quickly make that whatever disengagement we might be perceiving among students has something to do necessarily with us, or necessarily with the content or the classroom material or our course. When in fact, again, they're people, and they're people in the world, and they've got real stuff going on. Their parents might be ill, or they might be breaking up with a partner, or they might have just traveled back from a trip, and that really has nothing to do with what's going on in the classroom. I would also say, because I feel this way about what's happening nationally and globally, I think sometimes, overwhelm and disengagement and a protective impulse is the right kind of response in some situations. So if you're having a student, for whatever reason, with the content who's really not connecting with it, or is feeling like this isn't for me, or gosh, I've heard this so many times, or this doesn't represent my lived experience, then I think it's actually a very reasonable reaction for that student to perhaps put up a little bit of a wall, or to resist it in fact, like very polite ways, right? Just not talking, or having somewhat of a grumpy expression on their face. I think that's actually perfectly appropriate and perfectly reasonable in many situations. I certainly know when I talk about like privilege in my classrooms, that's going to be very let's say, eye-opening for some students, very difficult for some students to appreciate or to accept or to find connection to. And then there's going to be other students who I would expect maybe to check out a little bit because this may be something they're quite familiar with, depending on different identities and in the ways that they have been in the world or been in classrooms. And so I don't know that it's always on me necessarily to make sure that every single person at every single moment on every single day is excited or, connected or stimulated.
I think people mishear the approach of a learner-centered classroom to think that everything is personal and about the relationship between the learner and the teacher, right? So part of what I hear you saying is much of what we do in a relational classroom is not to take things personally.
Isn't that
That's a
funny?
hard lesson.
Yes. And I'll tell you, one of the best things that I've done for myself in taking things less personally is just to teach for a really long time. I haven't necessarily found a ton of shortcuts for that. I took things so personally earlier in my career, and I really felt such a, like you were talking about, such a strong sense of responsibility for each and every student and for the success of each and every student, and everyone should be engaged at every moment, every class. And I realized again, because they're human beings, just like I'm a human being, and they're going to have all sorts of other things going on. And so for me, one of the, I feel like, areas of progress I've made over my career has been learning to not take things so personally, to realize it's not always, it's sort of self-centered in a way, to realize it's not always about me. And these are not always problems that I personally can fix, right? And in my teaching or in the duration of just one class, one semester, I'm not going to be able to, radically take over some student's life and vastly improve it. The influence that I have is actually quite minor in many respects. But that's been a gift, really, to learn to let go of some of that responsibility that I might feel for students, their engagement, their success, their grades, their experience at the university.
I think along the spectrum of possibilities in learner-centered classrooms too, is when the students or a student tries to become then a disciple, right? Dr. Gravitt is fabulous. I want to move in with her. I'll meet her at her car. You know what I mean? That overindulgence, and faculty tend to like that. I have never, I mean, I've always been suspicious of the discipled student.
So I'm working on a textbook right now on religion and disability, and in the chapter on teachings, so religious teachings as they intersect with disability, I talk about the power dynamics between teachers and students, but I bring up this sort of disciple almost, the followers and the adoration and the ego stroking. And what I really want for students is I want students to think for themselves. I want students to honor that inner voice that they have. I want them to challenge me, to question what I'm presenting to them, to do that with other scholars, to do that with the course material. I don't want them to just accept whatever it is I assign as gospel, pun intended. I want them to have a much more dynamic interaction with me and with the material. And I would, like you, that makes me very sort of nervous or uncomfortable, this notion that our students would come to sort of almost put us at the center of learning rather than the learning process itself or the material or their own set of skills and knowledges, and development.
How did you learn, or what do you do to watch the dynamics in your classroom, right? So there's multiple levels of things going on in the classroom. And I had to train myself to watch dynamics in the classroom, because I wanted to learn it in a classroom, because it is a complex and difficult space to be in. But what are some of the things that you do, and how did you learn to monitor in your classroom in the best of ways? I'm not talking about surveil students.
The
I'm talking.
panopticon.
Sorry.
I have a panopticon set up in the middle of my class. That's how I do it. No, I yeah, this has been an ongoing process for me. Some of the things I do are setting up community early on. So I've written about some of this for Wabash blog posts in the past, but getting to know students through early semester questionnaires in more
Mm-hmm.
personal ways and figuring out what helps them learn and what they expect from the class, what they already think they know about religion in the first place, and whatever the topic of the class is. And then we also build community norms together as a group in class. And so those expectations, those criteria come from the students themselves. They are generated by groups of students. And of course, I'm a member of the community too, so I have input and we discuss and we clarify and we amend. And then those come up throughout the semester. So for instance, just on the midterm that my students took, I asked them to look back at those community norms and figure out how they were doing and how they wanted to adjust their behavior or performance or way they showed up for the rest of the semester. But it also has to do with checking in with students, with giving ample time in class to ask questions about how things are going. How long did it take you all to take that midterm? That's good information for me to have. Or, projecting those norms and asking, how do we think we as a group are doing? Or, I'm noticing some chatter over here. Can you all tell me what that's about? So really, again, I think the foundation is really important to build those relationships, to build that community with the students and each other. And then having that to refer to or fall back on as the semester goes, so that I can then get openness and honesty from them when I do check in, when I make those observations, or when I ask for mid-semester feedback, and doing it in lots of different ways, creating specific time for it, creating anonymous opportunities like polls for it, talking one-on-one with students. I think there's a lot of different ways, and I'm constantly sort of trying to add new ways to my toolkit. I wouldn't say this is a, I would never really say this is a process that I've got down pat or that I've perfectly honed. It's something that's it's in progress for me.
So this, I'm just going to say this a little bizarre. I've written about it. I watch my students breathing, right? And one of the questions I ask early in the semester when I was in the classroom is, when did they finally exhale? Like, did they do it during the first session? Did they wait till the third? Because you literally feel the students as a group breathe together or not.
Or not.
And I knew it would be a difficult semester if they waited like till session three, four, or five, right? Or if they started breathing in session one or two. And I'm like, yes, they trust me. We can go.
Yeah,
So,
they're
and
feeling
I don't mean that
comfortable.
metaphorically. I'm like literally watching to see if they breathe.
Well, and we forget we're bodies. I think we live the life of the mind, and so we imagine we're just like heads floating around, but we actually have bodies and we have physical sensations and we breathe. And so I love that kind of paying attention to that. Often in my classes, because students lately have seemed just sort of so stressed and overwhelmed, and I'll do mindfulness exercises with them. I'll offer a few minutes at the beginning of class, and it's always, by invitation, it's not required. My eyes will be closed. I won't know if you opt in or opt out. Feel free to do anything else during that time that calms or soothes you. But, a body scan or some box breathing or things like this. And it's unbelievable the way that they just melt. They're not used to it. I think none of us are really used to breathing,
That's
paying
true.
attention to our
That's true.
breathing,
That's true.
taking a moment to just try to calm our system down a little bit. So I'm going to for sure use this from now on, paying attention to the breathing in the classroom, in
Well,
addition to
and
trying to help them.
so many, we will enter a space and still be where we just came from,
Yes.
right? How do you get most of yourself in this space? I would also watch students' shoulders. When you're scared and you put your shoulders up around your ears. Like, how many sessions does it take them to move their shoulders down where they're supposed to be and
We
not up
hold
around their
tension
ears
in our
without a
shoulders, in
doubt?
our jaws.
All of that.
Yes,
But
it's something that you just,
watching the dynamics to me is
yes.
also about saying, okay, where are we? And then when I can get you to relax, then I can push a little bit on something that
Yes.
might need to be pushed. Otherwise, we're just there trying to look at the clock and hope the time's up real quick.
I know. And that's not great for anybody. It doesn't feel good as an instructor either when you're sort of pulling teeth
That's right.
through a class session. But I do feel that sometimes t being tense is also an okay response to what's happening too. For some students or for some topics or for some difficult conversations. And so how can we support one another through that? Or how can we make that something that can be faced together?
I absolutely agree. And because learning is difficult.
Yes.
Right. So many learners, particularly adult learners, want to be affirmed for what they already know rather than learn something new.
Yes.
And those who will say, yes, I'm interested in learning. Learning is hard. Learning is challenging.
It's uncomfortable. It's embarrassing.
Yes,
I actually have been advising people, and I try to do this myself, like put ourselves into learning situations again, because I think as older adults, we get to basically opt out of learning, certainly learning publicly for some grade. Mm-hmm. When was last time any of us did anything publicly for a grade? You know, and I have so much empathy for students. What they're doing is so difficult. They're not just learning one thing. They're learning many things. In many cases, especially with religion, it's not just learning from a blank slate or learning from scratch or zero. It's often unlearning problematic assumptions or ideas, and then trying to learn more correct, perhaps, things that we might want to be teaching them or having them leave our classrooms with. This stuff is really hard, really challenging. And so I think it's important for us to remind ourselves what it's like to be a learner, how hard it can be, how embarrassing, how foolish you feel, how frustrated, how you want to give up, how you don't want to go. I think that's absolutely right. This is tough. And so I think part of our job is also to give students the support and the skills to be able to move through that difficulty, not to avoid it, not to always preempt it, but to be able to live with the discomfort and to know that probably through practice, probably through repetition, probably through just time passing in some cases, that it will get easier. It will get survivable or durable. Or
trust the process. Just keep showing up. I'll get you to the end of the class.
Yeah.
I know how to do this.
Right.
Some classes I would talk to my students about, this is a contestable idea.
Yes.
Right. Not all ideas are benign or flat or agreeable.
Right.
Right. We are talking about this not because it's right or wrong, but because it needs to be. So for many students, that was a new place to locate themselves in a conversation. Right. So many had been taught, particularly students of faith, if it's contestable, it's to be avoided.
Right.
No, in this place called school, it's contestable. So we launch into it.
Let's put it in the center. Let's rotate it around. Let's look at it from different angles. You know, and I always tell my students, listen, I'm happy for you to critique. I want you to critique. But first, we do need to understand. We need to be able to sort of neutrally and fairly summarize and describe so that we all are on the same page about what the thing is that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then we can get into it. And then we can pull holes, and then we can ask questions. But we need to first have that understanding. And then we can get into that space where we're really looking critically at something. But I want to make sure at least we even know what's going on in the first place. I think students, and many of us actually, we like being critical in the academy as well. I think many of us want to jump right over that understanding portion, especially with things that are repugnant to us, right?
With crowbars, let's just tear it down, tear it up,
yes,
and then walk away.
Well, yes,
let's not just tear stuff
yes.
up.
Absolutely.
Is there something to be built? Is there something to be made? Is there something worth endeavoring in rather than just tearing stuff?
Yeah. Well, and, Emily, and yeah, go ahead.
No, finish your thought.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this brings me back to our earlier conversation about power, which is, you know, the power of ideas, the power of those knowledges in the plural that you mentioned. So there's dynamics there, too, in terms of which ideas get space, which ideas students gravitate toward or uphold. And so I think part of the power in classrooms is not just among the people or between different sets of people, but also we have to realize that ideas sort of carry power and knowledge is power in a certain way. And so helping students, you know, grapple with that is an important part of the power dynamic in our classroom space.
So my syllabus serves many roles and functions in a classroom. One of the primary things it does is it shows my biases about ideas that I have now packaged for you, right?
Yeah.
All the ones that didn't make the cut, all the choreography that I have
put
in this thing called syllabus, you now know what my biases are about many of the knowledges that I teach and produce.
That's right.
We should feel a sense of humility about that rather than, here it is, now do it.
Right.
Right. So... Anyway, thank you, Emily, for this conversation. It's
Thank
been
you so
fascinating.
much. It was
Please
wonderful to talk with you.
come back at another time.
Absolutely.
To our listeners, the Wabash Center website is the place. Look on our website for details concerning our regranting program, our resources on teaching, as well as our cohort groups. A special thanks to podcast producer Rachel Mills. The music which frames our podcast is the original composition of Paul Myrie. Wabash Center for more than 29 years is exclusively funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated. And we are out. How was that, Paul?